Hi, this is Tanya Domi. Welcome to The Thought Project, recorded at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, fostering groundbreaking research and scholarship in the arts, social sciences, and sciences. In this space, we talk with faculty and doctoral students about the big thinking and big ideas generating cutting-edge research, informing New Yorkers and the world. Justin Brown is the executive director of the Center for LGBTQ Studies, also known as CLAGS, at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Dr. Brown is also an assistant professor of health sciences at LaGuardia Community College, where his teaching primarily centers on courses in public health and human services. His collaborative research focuses on addressing health inequities among persons of color, LGBTQ, youth, and those populations at the intersection. Prior to CLAGS, Dr. Brown was the deputy director of the CUNY Institute for Health Equity and worked for several years running one of the only national social service agencies dedicated exclusively to working with LGBTQ youth of color. Brown completed his doctoral training with a health concentration in the Critical Social Personality Psychology program at the Graduate Center. Welcome to the podcast, Justin.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So today we're going to talk about the Center for LGBTQ Studies, also known as CLAGS, which was founded in 1991, and it is the first university-based research center in the United States dedicated to the study of historical, cultural, and political issues of vital concern to the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, as well as queer individuals and their communities. By sponsoring public programs and conferences, offering fellowships to individual scholars, and functioning as an indispensable conduit of information, CLAGS serves as a national center for promotion of scholarship that fosters social change. CLAGS' founder is the eminent American historian Martin Duberman, a professor emeritus at the Herbert Lehman College. He is also a biographer, playwright, and gay rights activist. There have been 8 directors of CLAGS since its beginning, including the present-day executive director, Justin Brown. What a legacy and a responsibility to lead CLAGS. You are now concluding your first year of a 3-year post. What can you tell us about the work of CLAGS at this moment, especially in light of the Trump presidency?
Well, I have to, in thinking about this year and reflecting upon it, this year has been truly one of really learning and also planning and reflection. I think that a lot of what this year was focused on in part was really trying to assess kind of where we are, given certainly the political climate that we are in today, given the continual cuts that we see with funding and the limited offerings of programming, and then the further kind of very anti-gay, homophobic, LGBT, non-friendly,
transphobic,
everything that we're really seeing existing in the current legislation that's being proposed and actions that are taken. And so with that, I kind of wanted to also take this year to take some time to see functionally where we also were and getting insights from those that have come before me. So I really wanted to take this opportunity to kind of learn from the past and the history in order to help move us forward in a direction. And so this year, I think in light of everything where we've been, it's been difficult and challenging at times, certainly. However, I think on the other side of this, we've come out with really coming through with a much more clear, more diverse approach to kind of how we have to learn to maneuver in an era of today in terms of funding for sustainability purposes, and also ensuring that we really take aim at that we're focusing on providing programming that isn't what I would say is programming for programming's sake, but the programming has a true purpose of kind of advocacy and social change and uplifting of the community. I think that that is one of the huge aspects that we're hopefully looking forward to in the exciting years to come.
That's pretty interesting. So when you talk about diversity, what are you talking about? Because that can mean a lot of things about the LGBTQ community.
I think for me, and in part, I think going back to at heart with my work, I think that part of the inclusion of diversity is that sometimes we're quite fractured. I think that there are moments in time where there's still serious issues of classism that may arise. There's issues that may arise on kind of understanding the voice of young youth today. I think that, some of the very interesting conversations and dialogue that I've had even more as of late between younger generation youth and older generation individuals that kind of see the fluidity of their identity and the, I guess, the forward nature in some of the things and that they do and how they're approaching.
I was actually going to talk to you about this later, but maybe we should just get into this. I mean, Walt Whitman, the great American poet, once said, "We are multitudes," and boy, does that ever apply to the millennial generation. They are multiracial. They have multi-identities, self-proclaimed, non-gender-conforming, soon to be released, as you know, the Public Science Project has this study coming out called What's Your Issue? And they're looking at more than 130 different identities that the survey participants actually self-identified as. And I think that this is probably really alienating in many ways. It's my own experience as a white lesbian. I've seen it in the community that, in fact, a lot of older white people in the LGBTQ community are really kind of freaked out about it because they don't see it as the movement that they grew up in. And indeed, it's not the same movement.
I agree. I think it is a different movement. It's a movement that is a movement of movements in many ways. And thinking about, movements such as the Black Lives Matter movement and the Me Too movement and other additional movements that are going on, I think that in the past, there may have been moments when there was this strong need of a clear, distinctive LGBT-specific movement. And there are certainly, but it's not perfect, but I think that there are certainly levels of not, I want to say full inclusion, but there are moments of youth and the millennials today making their voices heard within those particular larger movements and staking their claim to say, I'm a part of this too, and I'm not going to be silenced anymore.
Yes, and I'm Black or I'm brown and I'm an environmentalist or I'm undocumented or I'm a female or I'm many different things, but you need to make room for me because this is who I am and this is how I live my life. This is where I live at the intersections.
Definitely.
And do you see that reflected in the research of the academy? Because once it happens in the popular society, in the popular culture, how does that, or does it get reflected in the academy in your view?
I think, unfortunately, that the academy is still a very non-inclusive space. I think the academy, to some extent, is very, still very white hegemonic, patriarchal system that is non-inclusive. And I just think that the structure and how it has historically and continues to exist is one that may never get to the point of kind of that full acceptance and inclusion that we hope for. But I think that a counter argument to the academic today is the existence of such things as open educational resources and open access journals and finding alternative mediums and spaces that, although maybe not fully included as a quote-unquote acceptable as academic work, are academic work, and that there are slow movements within the academy by individuals from the community themselves that are making and staking the claim that the work that I do that may not be quote-unquote traditional work is just as valid and if not even more important, because I think that that's the work that actually creates movement and change and actually has an impact.
Even in your discipline, in which the Graduate Center is known for in critical psychology, I mean, it is one that empowers those who were formerly subjects to actually participate side by side as participants in the research. That in and of itself is really quite innovative and really quite non-academic, shall we say.
Definitely. And I actually would say that, you know, within my training and within my work, I think that that's in part created some existence of space now in the academy that we have young, new emerging scholars that see that this is the way that scholarship should and will be done and are very unapologetic about that.
You're part of that, Justin. You are a persona of that. And actually, given this discussion, I mean, I just want to mention to our listenership that CLAGS gives significant visibility during the academic year to two major awards. One is the Kessler Lecture that went to Sarah Ahmed this past December. Her lecture was entitled Queer Use. She is a self-described feminist writer. Indeed, her blog is entitled Feminist Killjoy. I have some mixed reactions to that. Who is also an independent scholar and works at the intersection of feminist, queer, and race studies. And next month, most excitingly, is you're going to award the Jose Munoz Award, which will be presented to Patrice Cuffers, a co-founder of Black Lives Matter, openly lesbian, self-describes as an artist, organizer, and freedom fighter, also claims herself to be the wife of Harriet Tubman. These two queer, lesbian, feminist women of color could not be imagined when Martin Duberman launched CLAGS in 1991. And what do you see? I mean, what do you see not only happening, as we already discussed in the movement, but wow, you are reflecting this in the academy, no less. This is really pretty remarkable in my view.
Certainly. I mean, I think that part of it is certainly, it is attempting also to continue to push and expand, even amongst ourselves, what should be included as individuals that are represented in these touted awards, and also should be recognized for the type of work and the actions that they do. I think that a lot of what they also do is not just things that have some historical importance, but they also are doing critical movement activities today. I mean, for example, Sarah and her work, I think one of the most, you know, pivotal things, the fact that, you know, she kind of really attempted and has done to work within the academy to kind of make them reveal themselves of the system that is a system of oppression that continually exists. And despite putting structures, quote unquote, in place to dismantle that, they've essentially created committees, or they've created diversity councils, or they've created offices of inclusion that are kind of there in
In name.
But not right? really doing anything.
But not really actually operating in a diverse, inclusive way.
Yes.
So it's interesting about Sarah because she's been in the Academy and outside of the Academy, and probably it's due to her level of comfort and freedom that she is indeed an independent scholar. Is that not true?
I do. I think that certainly that is probably part of it. But I also think that at a core, that one of the most revealing things I think about her, and I think that also speaks to Patrice and many other scholars of kind of the same
genre.
Uh-huh. And I think that they, in their unapologetic nature, is that they also have this understanding of no fear, that as I see it. I think I see this no fear as being a place of saying, why shouldn't I be able to be who I am, represented of people as being as equal, or there is some level of equity that exists, and I shouldn't actually continue to live in a system because by being silent, I'm literally just, perpetuating and continuing a cycle. And if I don't speak out or take action.
Well, these women, I didn't meet Sarah, but just reading about her and reading her blog, I mean, she's so powerful. It just sort of jumps off the page at you, her power. And Patrice Cuffers, who I have seen on television before, and the first time I saw her, I went, wow. I mean, this was at the beginning of the trajectory of Black Lives Matters. And I realized that a couple of people that led Black Lives Matter were both Black women who were openly lesbian. At the time, I, in fact, was chair of Get Equal, the board of directors of Get Equal, which was a civil nonviolent disobedience action group for the community, and working at the intersections, which confused a lot of white men in the movement. And when I saw Patrice on television, I went, wow, look at her. And you just don't see those images of openly lesbian Black women just every day on MSNBC, for example. And so I actually look forward to the Munoz event myself. I plan to attend, but tell me why you picked her, and what do you think she will bring to CLAGS to 365 Fifth Avenue on that day?
I think the process in which you're going through, as you know, with any of these types of awards, and the selection process is not an easy one. And there's always a large number of very qualified and deserving candidates. With Patrice, I think that part of the history of when this was kind of coming to the realization in the mind of my predecessor Kevin Nadal and some of the other board members and the team here at the Graduate Center was that they wanted to really ensure that they were kind of highlighting someone that was really doing the work in creating some social change or representation in their art or in their work, or something that was not necessarily within the tradition of the Academy. And with Patrice and in the selection of Patrice, the idea of kind of what she and the rest of the co-founders and she's the founder of her own, kind of action organization and movement that is really one that has embraced been inclusive of, I think, a younger millennial generation that in many times has felt excluded from having a seat at the table, so to speak. And I think that also there's a level of connection that she's able to make and enliven kind of this passion of wanting to pick up and continue to do this work. I also think that she pushes the boundary in terms of the diverse set of social change and social justice issues that she's focusing on. I mean, things such as, you know, prison reform to, to ending violence. And I think it just goes on and on and on. And so I agree when you mentioned, when you saw her on when you saw her on TV and MSNBC, it was the first time I saw her. And I freely admit, I was, when I saw this, I was preparing actually for a talk I was giving. And there was one portion of an actual video that she had done on MSNBC, and it was an outtake. And it was really the first time that I had seen in that kind of an arena the recognition of LGBT youth of color on such a stage as that, and in the way in which there was a level of inclusion in the conversation of them to be a part of the Black Lives Matter movement. And so I think that she is doing, right, the work of that's at the intersection, and speaking and advocating for our communities to ensure that they're not forgotten, they're not overlooked, and that we are actually held accountable to put, quote unquote, like our money where our mouth is, and putting it towards really strong issues that need to be addressed that have not been addressed, mm-hmm. as opposed to putting our money behind maybe things that might have some social significance.
This actually segues to a point I like to hear your response to, but I'll just say one more time, when I saw her the first time, I did a double take. I went, oh my God, this person, you don't see this person on television. And I was really, really blown away. I hung on to every word. So speaking of that, for example, you know, the National Advocacy Organization spent a lot of time on marriage equality. That was the last victory. We haven't done anything since, really. We're now treading shark-infested waters. And the gap between youth and what the national advocacy organizations are doing is, I think, growing. It's grown because if you're, you know, if you're 12, 13, 14 years old, if you're homeless and on the street, marriage equality doesn't mean anything to you. And while there are some groups like GLSEN, but that's for kids in school, a lot of LGBTQ kids are not in school because they're on the street. There's a huge gap about the needs of this generation. And one of my fears, as we're treading water and we're going to have to play defense, major defense, that youth are going to be really not at the forefront of what we're concerned about. Therefore, I think about universities and I think about CLAGS and its role here and where youth are. If they are in school and they're fortunate enough to get to college, like at LaGuardia Community College where you teach, at least they're in a university setting. So that's why I think what you're doing at CLAGS has even more importance at this time. I'd just like to hear your thoughts on that.
I agree. And, I tell people all the time that I always kind of claim my statement of my opinion or my perspective on things. But having, you know, come from the background of working for small nonprofit organizations and working with LGBT youth of color that, you know, and primarily homeless or marginally housed. And, to me, that is where I always keep my center. So I think that to some extent, almost as, I think that we need to hold the larger national organizations certainly accountable for placing this as a key part of their agenda. However, I also think that we need to start to think in new ways about working and arming smaller community-based organizations and smaller movements within cities and parts of the country, that this is the work that they do passionately every day, and they can be the voice that can collectively work together to form coalitions and collaborations and uplift and make their own way in finding a place at the larger table of the national organizations. I think that,
that's fair enough. I mean that there's a lot of people doing great work at the community level. I can see that from your biography. You've done a lot of that work yourself. Let me just ask one other question. I mean, Donald Trump is the 800-pound, you know, gorilla, elephant, herd of elephants, no insult to elephants, in the room. And we're all sitting here going, oh, my God, what is going to happen today? That isn't a strategy, clearly, but a lot is hanging in the balance. I mean, his ban of trans people from open military service was, the commander in chief has a lot of leeway on how they determine who serves. It's going to be taken up in court, obviously, but to put a target on the backs of trans people is just really horrific. We know that hate crimes have skyrocketed since he's been president. And there was a peak on election day, as a matter of fact, in the period before and after the election. And now Mike Pompeo, one of the most homophobic and transphobic people, is leading the State Department, and God only knows how that's going to outpicture itself with respect to LGBTQ human rights throughout the world. Do you think about this as you prepare for your second year? I mean, is there? This is something that everybody's talking about in their day-to-day life, and then Clegg's at the center of, you know, scholarship and programming, and where people come together to be together too. How does that shape your thinking? How does it inform your thinking as you prepare for year two?
I think it is certainly something that weighs on my mind, and it's something that's there all the time. And beyond the 800-pound elephant, and looking at the rest of his administration is terrifying to me as well. To think that even if something, you know, if that 800-pound elephant were to tumble and fall, that I'm not certainly sure that there would be much change beyond that with Pence and down the line. And so I certainly do think that this is something that has continued to force us to think and to reconvene around developing a strategy that may include things that might be outside of a bit of the realm of what we've historically done. And I know that can be uncomfortable, right? Change is not always an easy thing for organizations to undertake. But I think that certainly part of what we need to continue to do is also back to some of the other things that have historically been done around really also making this, you know, the statement of kind of social change and advocacy central to what we do by not only our programming, but also broadening our strategy on who we reach and how we reach those communities. So I think in part, really thinking about in the past is how things have been done, such as the seminars in the city that have been undertaken by CLAGS in the past, working with and strategically with community partners to provide programs that are in those spaces, broadening our training and education to be inclusive of things such as not only educating our students, building a pathway from community college to the four-year to graduate school, but also to educating the larger populace. So trying to figure out how can we work to really highlight and provide even the basic, you know, LGBTQIA 101 to teachers, to organizations that really lack that cultural responsiveness. And I think that when I think that when you push them to that space of having to look hard in the face of what they're facing, and question why and how their skewed views or perceptions may have actually developed, as to why it's okay to be exclusionary, why it's okay to accept the fact that there's a whole segment of our society that's not, we don't hear about on the TV, you know, the fact, as you mentioned before, you know, violent crime and against trans women of color, and just the continually raising rates that continues to occur at, but yet we don't hear it, it's silenced, it's not seen. I think that it's our turn now to kind of force that issue, and through, you know, I don't want to say formal lobbying, but, you know, moving in the direction of finding our space to be able to, you know, continue to kind of maybe develop policy pieces, develop this additional arm that's going to kind of speak to back to the legislation and to counteract the narrative that currently exists.
Well, Justin, thank you so much for being here with us today. And we will have you back to give us a situation report.
All right. I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks for tuning into The Thought Project. And thanks to our guest, Professor Justin Brown. The Thought Project was produced in partnership with CUNY TV, located at the Graduate Center in the heart of New York City, with production, engineering, and technical assistance by Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz. I'm Tanya Domi. Tune in next week.